You're now in the huddle with Coach Calls Timeout, the podcast that dissects the mind of a different basketball coach every episode. We uncover what makes them successful and how their story translates to your coaching journey. Let's unlock your team's potential together. Welcome to episode 30 of the podcast. Today we have our first active NBA coach join the show. We have Scott Morrison, assistant coach of the Boston Celtics. We talked to him about his journey from a small town in Prince Edward Island, Canada, to head coaching stints at Lakehead University and the Maine Red Claws, and now as an assistant coach of the Boston Celtics. It's a story of hard work, some risk, and a trust in his abilities. Stick around after the interview for a discussion with myself and Brian on one of the questions of the forum we have at Coach Calls Timeout. We answer a question about making cuts for a 7th grade team. Brian handles the interview with Scott Morrison. You can follow along at coachcallstimeout.com/30. Welcome to episode 2, season 2 of the Coach Calls Timeout podcast. And tonight we're extremely fortunate to have the new assistant coach of the Boston Celtics, Scott Morrison, with us. Coach, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule to spend a few minutes with us here.
Yeah, oh, thanks for having me. Appreciate you giving me a shout and having me on.
We talk a lot about the journeys that coaches have had to get where they are. And I think one of the words that probably will come up on more than a couple occasions for me when talking about and looking into your journey is unique. Come from a small town, 300 people in Prince Edward Island, and you've made your way to the Boston Celtics coaching bench, which is absolutely fantastic, with stops along the way at Lakehead, where you won an OUA championship and turned that program into a perennial top 10 CIS team. And then a Coach of the Year award as the head coach of the Maine Red Claws in the what was the D League, which is now the G League. How driven were you? How did you get to where you are to be on the Celtics bench right now? How can you describe that?
Well, to be honest with you, I never really, made that a goal of mine until maybe after my second year of Maine or maybe after a year and a half with the Red Claws. The whole point of leaving Lakehead, was to just learn and become a better coach and try to, learn from the best, that I could possibly be exposed to. And, just happened to catch a few breaks along that quest to learn more and become a better coach, and was fortunate to get a couple opportunities that I was able to take, and led me to this point, which this summer has kind of fulfilled those goals that I had, which was to learn from the best, and I'm getting a chance to do that every day now. It's been great.
So let's talk about that process a little bit. What type of a decision was it to leave Lakehead right when, you were in the midst of really throwing together a fantastic program at a place that's difficult to recruit to, and decide at that point, hey, for some professional development, I'm going to go and try this. How does it come to that, and how did you get that opportunity?
Well, it wasn't anything crazy, really. I got my start in coaching from a coach named Carolyn Savoy, who recently passed away a couple of years ago. She was a longtime women's coach at Dalhousie. And, after 1 year of being her assistant coach, she took a sabbatical, to work with Pat Summer, who was a close friend of hers, and allowed me to coach her team for 1 year. It was only my second year of coaching. First year out of school, really. And, that kind of stayed with me as something that, wasn't a common option, but something that coaches could do in Canada. So the last contract I signed with Lakehead, I had negotiated a chance to do a 1 year sabbatical somewhere. I didn't know where it would be. Just, that idea really appealed to me because, it's tough when you're in a place like Thunder Bay or for that matter, any head coaching job, or you're so focused on your own team that it's hard to sometimes learn from other people. So I had that in my mind from Coach Savoy, and was able to put it in my contract, and it just so happened after my last year at Lakehead, we graduated 7 players. So it was as good a time as any to take a break and learn some new stuff and kind of regroup. So that's what I did. And the reason I ended up in Maine is when I first I was granted a sabbatical. I thought I'd just volunteer with the NBA team. I was pretty naive to think that I could just call some of these teams up and they'd let me hang out for a year. That's what I thought I'd do. And when that option kind of dried up, Coach Rana, Roy Rana, actually suggested I try the D-League. And I had two Facebook contacts of coaches in the D-League just by fluke. One of them happened to be the main coach, Mike Taylor. So I sent a message on Facebook and kind of reminded him who I was and what I was trying to do. And he said, come on down. You can come down. It won't be very glamorous, but at least you can be here and kind of see what this level is all about. So I took him up on the opportunity and kind of been a name ever since then.
And how big of a risk do you believe it was to commit to staying?
Personally, I don't think it was that big of a risk. The sabbatical was a great thing for me because I could go risk-free. I still got a portion of my salary, and I didn't take any money from Maine. I wasn't a paid employee there, but I still was paid from Lakehead and still worked for Lakehead while I was gone. And then when the opportunity came up to coach the Red Claws, I was getting ready for the following season with the Thunderwolves, and got the call in mid-August, and I felt bad and I hated to leave at kind of a short notice, but it was just an opportunity that I saw that I couldn't turn down. I would never come back again. Just to put me close to a coach like Brad Stevens and an organization like the Celtics, even though I wasn't there, just to be around and be a part of that and get a chance to experience a new level, I just couldn't turn it down. And I figured, I guess, worst case scenario, they'd fire me after a year or two and I probably would still have a chance at a CIS job down the road, just with the success we had at Lakehead. So I didn't take it as a big risk, but, to me, more of a risk would have been just staying in it and passing on it because it might not come around again.
And now you end up at Maine. What is, can you explain for us who would have no idea, what would be generally described as the role of a head coach of a D-League team? Are there things that you do that people would find unbelievable? Are you driving the bus? Are you doing the uniforms? Or is it strictly coaching?
The year I volunteered, the year of my sabbatical, I did everything. I picked up numerous jock straps or underwear off the floor. I guess jock straps is I'm dating myself with that term, but tights, towels, drove the bus, the bus broke down, did the laundry. All kinds of stuff, anything you can imagine that, managers would basically be doing. I was also able to do some basketball stuff too, but not without the other. As a head coach, head coaches in America are treated pretty good. That's what I learned quickly, and I tried never to abuse that. But at the end of the day, you are treated with a certain level of respect that maybe you don't get in Canada, at least outside the gym. And I tried to make the most of that, but D-League is still a grind. It's really facilities and travel and sport-wise, no different than any university, to be honest. So it was kind of a sideways step from that regard for me. Meanwhile, a lot of our players are coming from high-major Division I schools and European pro teams that were treated a lot better. So for them, it was more of an adjustment than me. But, our travel is very similar to Lakehead. Our budget wasn't much better either. So it wasn't a big adjustment for me, but, I didn't do anything that the Canadian coaches don't do probably on a weekly or monthly basis. So I was used to that. Maybe a little bit different if I was an American, coach coming from NCAA or the NBA assistant coming down to be a head coach.
And how much contact do you have, as a head coach in Maine with Brad and his group, at the Celtics level? Do you try and run similar things? Are they more interested in your professional development of the players rather than the schemes?
Yeah, 100%. When I was first hired, I remember, Danny Ainge sat me down and he said, listen, here's our goals for the D-League. Number one was player development of guys they think are prospects. Number two was creating an environment for healthy players to be assigned to Maine and come up to Maine and be surrounded with good examples and coaches that want to work hard with them and things like that. And then way down the list, like 7 or 8 points later, was to try and win. But in the process of creating that environment of player development and creating that positive environment, both with the players that we had full time and the coaches, those things ended up being the keys to being successful in the D-League. And we were lucky enough to get a number of wins and do pretty well. So it looked good for everybody, even though that wasn't our main goal. In terms of the Celtics, they were great and probably improved every year in terms of the relationship. You know, by the end of it, the start of last season, for example, Coach called me into his office and, you know, like every year, he said, you can run what you want, but the guys that get assigned to Maine from the Celtics have to be able to step in there on a moment's notice and know what they're doing. So a lot of stuff has to be similar, but there was two or three things that he, you know, was interested in from scheme's point of view. And he would ask me to try and focus on those in Maine, even if they weren't doing as much in Boston, just to get a look at it and see how things might look in a future year that he might want to try out.
I guess when the goal to win isn't necessarily near the top of the list, it makes the next question I was going to ask a little bit answerable without asking it. But the difficulty in coaching a group that does change frequently when you have people going up and down, does it make it more complicated, or because you are more focused on the development, it really doesn't matter?
Well, you would think that would be the answer, but at the end of the day, everyone's a competitor. And once that, you know, once you woke up on game day, you were trying to win. Definitely during the week leading up to the games, we would not sacrifice our player development for game planning, for example. We wouldn't do a whole lot of walkthroughs with the guys. And but once that game day hit, the coaches were ready. We had done our scouting. We had our game plan set up, you know, every time. And we introduced the scout and the personnel to the player that day, and it was all about winning. And we treat that like player development. You know, those guys who are in the D-League are usually trying to get you into the NBA or overseas. And whether they're a role player in the NBA down the road or whether they're a star overseas, their goal and what they're getting paid to do is win games. So we treated that as part of the development, but it didn't come up until usually game day or maybe the night before. And we learned that regardless of what they told me the goals were, everyone was excited when we won. Even though I never would have been judged on our wins and losses. I remember my first year, I think we went 14-3 or something like that to start the season. And everyone was fired up. They were, you know, they were saying congratulations on the win. They weren't talking about player development at the time, but at the end of the season, it would have been more about who improved and how much they did improve.
Well, and we talk about culture as well on Coach Calls Timeout. And I mean, when you're dealing in an organization where there's levels like that, I would imagine the culture is still a big thing, and winning helps develop that culture. So I don't think they'd be too discouraged about you winning games. That's for sure.
No question. Just not at the expense of player development. If we had a young guy that maybe deemed as a prospect, and perhaps there was an older player that on that given day could give us a little bit more or give us a better chance to win, we would still have to make sure that that young player is, you know, his due diligence.
And when you talk about the development, give us an idea. I think in the NBA, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the ratio of game to practice, once the season gets going, I mean, you'll have your walkthroughs and things, I'm sure, but the amount of practice that you actually do is probably limited. In the D-League, is there a greater emphasis? Is there still a lot more practice than game?
There's still a lot more game, I guess, than practice, at least compared to college or university. You can tell I've been in the States too long when I start staying college instead of the university, but at Lakehead, for example, we knew every week we had practices from Monday to Thursday, worst case scenario, and gave us lots of time to improve during the season, lots of time to prepare for the opponents. I love that about coaching at Lakehead and coaching university. The D-League is a little bit better than the NBA. It's a little bit more time between games usually, but there's also more travel time because you're not taking the private jet home after the game. You're waiting till the next morning and probably have a connection or two, so you lose some days there. But we were a little bit less worried about sleep and recovery time in the D-League, so we would probably sacrifice some of those things for extra workouts just to help the guys get better. Whereas with the Celtics, for example, you know, sleep and recovery time, those things are planned out for the whole season from day one. Coach Stevens is very careful to make sure that the guys are able to operate at their best, and that would probably take precedent over an extra practice here or there.
And now with the Celtics, has your role with that club been established yet?
Yeah, I mean, so far, so good, I suppose. Every assistant coach here, there's six or seven of us, really. When you want to count video guys, you're getting to almost 10 people. So there's a lot of resources here. It's very specific what you are assigned to do. And usually that means you're kind of in charge, or you work with a couple of the players, maybe work them out, you know, every day during the summer sometimes, watch a video with them, make sure they're good, and in the right frame of mind to play their best. And then guys are assigned to some sort of team aspect. So with myself, I've always kind of been more on the offensive side when I've been in Boston, whether it be the playoffs or summer league. So coach kept me on the offensive side and assigned me a couple of players that I've been working with basically since early August off and on. And it's a little different for me. It's not, I don't have to worry about everyone in the organization. I just have to worry about, you know, really three people, me and those two guys, and make sure we're all doing their job. And then if that works out, then I guess it'll be a successful year for me.
Now, you don't know this, but you and I have a very common background when it comes to offense. I believe you're still the all-time leader in the AUS with three-pointers made for a career. I'm also told in attempts as well. Someone told me to emphasize that. And believe me, there'd be a lot of people through the OCAA that would say that I probably have led the in career 3-point attempts as well. So the way the game has changed, and the emphasis is a little bit, it is a lot more on spacing and getting good threes and kind of the mathematics of it all. I would imagine that, I believe you have an economics background too. So you're a numbers guy. I believe the analytical side of this is probably right up your alley, and the way the Celtics spread the floor and shoot the three, although maybe not with the greatest of personnel to have done that in the past, but are getting better with some of the acquisitions that you made. I'm imagining that they've seen your offensive prowess in what you do, and that that would excite them. And I'm going to say that it excites you as well to be a part of that kind of progressive group and that type of offense. Am I right up right in assuming that?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. You're definitely right about my defense record, and to a less glamorous point, the Knicks record too. I don't think anyone here would probably believe that. It's been a long time. but I appreciate you bringing that up. But yeah, no, offense, I think some coaches, especially Dave Smart, would probably laugh when I tell him, which I did tell him, that I was working on offense because we had a hell of a time scoring on Carlton when I was at Lakehead, but our defense was always pretty good. But the year I took off and from Lakehead and went to Maine to volunteer, I thought I should study some aspect of the game on my free time, just like a professor might do on their own sabbatical. So I decided to study 3-point shot creation and shot selection because it was kind of a insane to look at. The Rockets were starting to make shot selection, you know, more famous or more popular, and the fact that they would only take threes and layups or try to. And my whole premise was that there's not every three is created equally, and there's better ways to get threes than others. Just shooting threes is not the answer, which is probably how I played, but realized soon as coaching that wasn't the best way to go about it. So I spent a lot of time studying how threes are created, what the best percentage threes were on average. And once I had my kind of theories and premises locked in, I just started trying to apply them to the NBA teams, and always sent Coach Stevens my, you know, trackings and findings of the Celtics. And I think he ended up at least being more aware of it and trying to use some of those teaching points with the team. And that's probably why he kept me on that side of the ball. So it's kind of a challenge to me to keep expanding on those thoughts and also looking for new ways to just generate good shots and team offense. So without getting into the boring details of it, that's basically what I spent a lot of time doing, and I guess to a certain extent it paid off for me.
It seems like at every step of the way, and in the way you talk and anything that I've read about you, like your work ethic is second to none. You're well organized. It sounds like you get things accomplished. And I think that that's probably appreciated. And it's also part of, you know, the buzzword kind of amongst you know, a lot of sporting things over the last few years is the process. Stick with the process. But I don't know what, if everybody understands what the process is, and it could mean different things to different people, but it seems to me like a heavy part of your process has been keeping your head down, doing, you know, hard work and letting everything around you take its course. And through that process has come the evolution of where you are today. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, some people say that I've worked hard and that's why I'm here. Or they say, you know, you've earned it with your hard work. But at the end of the day, I don't necessarily think I've worked harder than any other coach that I grew up, you know, watching or studying or eventually coaching against. To be honest, when I started at Lakemed, I didn't do very well and had an awful lot to learn. And it wasn't until, you know, I kind of became very close to losing my job a couple of times that I said, man, you got to work harder. But just obviously you're not working as hard as other people. And if you're going to go down and this isn't going to work out for you, then you may as well go down knowing that you worked as hard as you could to try and make it happen. So that was a turning point for me. And I don't think my hard work made me any better of a coach, but perhaps we were more prepared and perhaps I just earned a little bit of good karma along the way to maybe get a recruit or two that we didn't deserve or wouldn't have gotten at another time. That helped us get over the hump at Lakehead. And as a result of that, opportunities came with, you know, Canada basketball and this one here. So I think there's lots of better coaches than me out there and probably lots of coaches that are also working hard, as hard or harder than me. But with hard work sometimes comes a little bit of luck. And if you get a little bit of luck and are in a position to take an opportunity, you can sometimes get some places that you never thought you'd get to, I guess.
That's your humble East Coast mentality at its best. Very good. Very good. We talk a lot about mentors and mentoring at Coach Calls Timeout. And a lot of the coaches that we've talked to, some of the bigger names in Canadian basketball coaching, have all given us a list of different people that they've been mentored by. I'm going to guess that your biggest mentor is your dad. For those who don't know, your father, George Morrison, is a legend in Prince Edward Island. I believe he's in the Prince Edward Island Sports Hall of Fame and obviously the UPEI Hall of Fame. And I believe he also coached at Holland College for a couple of years there. But can you talk a little bit about what your dad and his life and coaching has meant to you?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I have a number of mentors and I've been lucky to have been exposed to a lot of people that have influenced me in a positive manner, but it's hard to beat the guy that introduces you to the game and teaches you everything that you know, at least to a certain point in your life or career. Coming from a really small town, probably odds are against you that you become a university head coach, let alone a pro head coach or an NBA assistant coach or whatever the case may be. But I was a little bit different than the average small town person because my dad was a university coach himself and I spent most of my days hustling home from school so I could go to practice and, you know, shoot around or watch or film or depending on how old I was, take part in any way I could. And as a result, I was exposed to some great players and good role models and that helped me get to a certain point in my career. And probably my best memories is my final season at Lakehead where we almost got it done. We made it to the finals and national championship final, lost to Carleton. And then about 5 days later, my dad's Holland College team was in the CKA finals. And neither of us were able to get it done in the end, but pretty good stories for both schools. And it was a nice way to finish it. That's how I finished my Canadian university career with both of us being in the finals at our respective level. And it was nice for me because I feel like he was a great coach. And it's rare in coaching that you get to go out on top. And he was able to, you know, retire after that year, be at the top and kind of enjoy the success that he had. And then get a chance to, you know, see me get to Maine and come to a lot of our games. And it was really nice being probably, you know, as close to home as possible at that level. So, yeah, I mean, I still take a lot from him. He was a self-taught coach. He came from an even smaller place than I did and learned the game his own way, grinding out to clinics and videotapes and things like that. And probably got by on work ethic more than anything. He was one of the last part-time coaches in Canada at the CIS level. And he still had to win a couple conference championships despite a lack of resources. So he was definitely a motivator for me, both at Lakehead to try and squeeze every bit we could out of the program and what resources we had. Then, you know, when I moved on, just to try and represent him and my mom and everyone else back home was the best that I could.
How often do you still bounce stuff off each other?
Well, to be perfectly honest, not much. You know, he kind of has always let me do my own thing. When I was at Lakehead, I would probably bounce a lot more off-court stuff off him than I would on the court. Probably because the game has changed a little bit, and also because he just wouldn't be the type to assume that he knew more than anyone else. But there's no question that I remember just about everything that happened, you know, growing up in terms of his coaching and on the court. I was around on the bench for a lot of those wins with UPEI and losses. And, you know, I still think of things that they did and try to see what I could tweak it or apply it to the level that I'm at. And there's no question there's still a big impact there.
And obviously huge Celtics fans.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, one of the first games I remember watching when I was a kid was Celtics Rockets. I don't know what year that was. It was 86. I just watched the 30 for 30, which would have had it. I remember my dad had a satellite dish, mainly to watch Indiana games. He's a big Bobby Knight fan. It probably didn't serve me very well later on in my life, but it was quite interesting at the time. And so we watched a lot of Indiana games, a lot of Celtics games, and looking forward to him getting down for a couple, him and my mom getting down for a couple games this year to see the Garden in person. Last year I took him to a game against the Suns, actually, with the game that Booker scored 70. That was his first game in the Garden.
So, wow.
Hopefully we can get him on the court pregame or whatever this year.
And with the Celtics now, you guys are just getting rolling. The media day we're taping this on the media day. How much or have you spent much time with any of the players yet?
Yeah, for sure. I got pretty lucky with the assignment this year. Coach assigned me to Gordon Hayward and Semi Ojeleye. And obviously everyone knows who Gordon is. He's, you know, one of the best players in the NBA. He was an all-star last year, and he's also a great guy. So I was really lucky to get a chance to work with him and really enjoying that. And then Semi Ojeleye, the second-round pick out of SMU, who, you know, he's really one of the best kids I've ever been around.
He's a beast.
He's a beast, but he's a friendly one, for sure, at least off the court. He's a great kid. The other benefit is that Gordon happens to live in San Diego in the offseason, so I was able to go out there for about a month and just help out, you know, with what he was doing, get to know him. And since those guys came back to Boston around Labor Day, we've been basically going every day with voluntary workouts. And it's really, when you step back and think about it, it's really kind of a dream come true. Like I said, I left Lakehead to get a chance to work for the best and work with the best. And between Brad Stevens and Gordon Hayward, it's pretty, you know, pretty well as close to the best you can get. But I try not to think about that too much, because if I do that, then I'll be doing those guys a disservice. They trust me to help them, and I'm just going to do whatever I can to do that. And sometime I'll look back and, you know, like I said, enjoy the fact that that even happened.
And have you spent much time with Jason Tatum at all yet?
Yeah, we had Jason in the summer league, so that's, you know, about a 3-week process. This year we did Utah and Vegas, plus a week of practice. And I had a couple of opportunities to work out with Jason this fall, and the coach that normally works with him was out of town for 3 or 4 days, and I got him and Shannon email together. And Jason's a great kid too. He works hard, obviously very talented, and I'm really rooting for him. I think a lot of people here think that he's going to have a great career. I think everyone's careful not to put too much pressure on him, rightly so, because he's only a 18 or 19 year old kid. But everyone likes him and makes it easier to root for him. And I think with our team being very young, especially on the bench, it'd be nice if he could step up. But I know he's going to have a great career just because of the approach that he takes every day. And like I said, it was easy to see that firsthand, you know, doing one-on-one workouts with him.
Well, my brothers and I are taking some of the credit for him being with the Celtics right now, because we were at the ACC championships, and we were at the Duke Notre Dame game, and Danny Ainge was sitting in the seat directly ahead of me, and we were we were commenting all game about how we thought Jason Tatum should be the number one pick in the draft because the NBA is all built on wing scorers. So I think Danny was listening to us and he ended up trading back because he knew he'd still be there. So we're taking some of the credit for him being there. So if he has a great career, it might be because of some of your player development, but a lot of it will be because we suggested to Danny to take it, even though he won't admit it, I'm sure.
Well, I'll have to mention that to him, but I'm sure you're correct. And I hope you're right, because that means that we're going to probably have a pretty good team if guys like him can step up and end up being as good as yourself and Danny think they're going to be, then we should be in good shape.
Now, you mentioned real quickly there his age. And what I'm finding these days is the NBA, I mean, in the NHL, you know, a hockey nation that we are, we've always seen guys get drafted at 18, you know, they end up in the minors or they stay in junior for a couple of years. And by 20, 21, 22, you start to reap some of that benefit. And lo and behold, here they are, unless they're those really, really special guys. It seems more and more in the NBA that guys obviously are getting drafted younger and younger, but it's almost like people give up on them so quickly. Do you find that people lose perspective on how young these guys really are and how much they could grow if given the opportunity to do so and the right guidance?
Yeah, no question. That's one of the things that kind of shocked me since I've been down here. One of probably many things, but the fact that guys can get written off because of their age. I know just, you know, from personal experience that you can keep improving, I'll take you up until your late 20s, early 30s. But in terms of the scouting side of this business, age is a major factor. The example I would use is Malcolm Brogdon from the Bucks. Actually, I had a chance to coach at the combine last spring when he was coming out, and he was on the team that I was working with. And I remember telling, you know, one of the scouts in our front office that, man, this guy should be, you know, up the draft board. He's going to be a really good player. You know, the response being probably every front office was saying, other than Milwaukee, was that, well, you're right, but he's already 23 or whatever he was. And, you know, for me, we used to recruit guys like that at 23, and I surely wouldn't expect them to get better, even if he only had 2 or 3 years left. But just so much drafting on potential here, those extra 3 or 4 years is a major, major thing, just like wingspan or, you know, hand width and all these other measurements that, to the, you know, old school type of person doesn't seem to mean a lot, but definitely has a lot of weight at this level. And sure enough, Brogdon turned out to be pretty good, but those same guys will probably say that, you know, this is as good as he's going to get. So we'll have to see what happens. But, seems like to me that Milwaukee made a pretty good move picking them. And, there's been a lot of 18, 19 year old guys that were picked in the last 3 or 4 years that didn't turn out to be, you know, the player that Malcolm Brogdon was, but perhaps that's just an anomaly. And perhaps the scouts are right in the fact that, you know, analytics would show that the studs are going to be a certain type of player, a certain age when they come out, and you can't win without studs.
Well, I agree with all that, certainly. And you guys have made a lot of changes in the offseason. I mean, half the roster's turned over, but it looks like it's going to be an exciting year. And we'll wish you all the best in your new role and your continuing climb up the coaching ladder. Maybe at the end of the season or to begin next season, we can get you back on after you got a year under your belt, and we can talk about the differences in what you did this year versus in the D-League.
Hey, it's Dan here. I'm just going to jump in real quick to tell you about us, Coach Calls Timeout. We're a basketball coaching resource. If you're a coach and you're looking for a single location to find plays, drills, or practice plans, check us out at coachcallstimeout.com. We have something that nobody else does. All our plays and drills are in video format, no still shots, and they can be downloaded directly to your laptop, phone, or tablet. All the videos are small enough files that you can send them to your players to use as a study guide, or you can use them during practices or timeouts. As a podcast listener, you can take advantage of our special offer. Go to coachcallstimeout.com right after this episode. When you're signing up to become a member, just use the coupon code PODCAST, and you'll receive a free 7-day trial to sample everything we have to offer. Let's get back to the interview and the full court press.
we end every episode with something we call Full Court Press, and it's just some small, quick questions that we're just looking for very one-word or short answer responses. So if you're up for it, I'll throw you some quick Full Court Press questions to end this thing.
Yeah, for sure. Let's go.
All right, here we go. Your team's up 3. Other team's got the ball. 5 seconds left. Are you fouling?
I'm not a foul guy, although analytics would say that in the NBA at least you should foul.
Your favorite sport outside of basketball?
Baseball.
The best player to date that you've coached?
That'd be Chris Babb. Not counting this season, of course.
The arena that you're most excited about visiting this season behind the bench?
Probably Toronto.
And finally, I'm supposed to ask you, how are you on elevators?
I don't like them. If I'm the only one on there and I have like a little bit of fluid or something that I'm coming back to the room with, I can deal with it. But otherwise, if I have the option, I'm taking the stairs 100%.
Roy Rand asked me to ask you about that.
Well, yeah, Roy, working with Roy, we've been to some pretty unique locations for these tournaments. I can recall one in Brazil where the elevator was probably big enough for maybe 2 people, but those guys would shut me in there and then start jumping up and down. So hopefully I won't be on when it happens, but probably those guys get stuck in one of these summers, and I won't feel one bit bad for them.
All right. Well, hey, wish you all the best. Thank you very much for joining us, Coach.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Appreciate you having me. Have a great night.
All right, you too.
There you have it. I love the self-reflection from Coach Morrison that he felt he needed to work harder to achieve his goals. That hard work led to more recognition, more success, and as he said, maybe some good karma. All that resulted in job security and the ability to take a chance, trust his skills, and find a role that would allow him to learn more about the game himself and coaching. I'm sure he's going to have the time of his life coaching with the Celtics this season. For anyone that doesn't know, we have a forum on our website, coachcallstimeout.com, where coaches can go to talk shop, learn from each other, and gain experience without even being in the gym. I gave Brian a call recently to talk about one of the questions on the forum about making cuts for a 7th grade team. Let's listen in. Okay, so we have this new question from Wes Will on the forum. I'm new to coaching and was wondering how many players I should keep for my 7th grade team. Should I go with the conventional 12 or should I go with less or more? I'm expecting about 20 at tryouts. Thanks, Wes. Bri, what are your thoughts on how many people you should keep for that age group?
Well, I saw Ebe, who coaches Langara out in British Columbia, I saw he responded to it and thought it was fine to keep all 20 and that you should be able to run practices with that many kids at that age. At that age and that level, I hate to discourage anybody from playing who wants to play. So I tend to agree with Ebe in that I think probably keeping them all isn't a terrible idea. Obviously, the difficulty becomes when you're trying to keep that many people happy when you're actually playing games. So, maybe you have what you could call a taxi squad or something and you keep your 12 and you tell the other 8, hey, we're going to allow you to practice with us and get better and improve and be part of all the drills and skills and different things that we do every day in practice. And then when it comes to game time, you know, you guys are our taxi squad or kind of our head cheering squad. And that way you hopefully don't lose any of the kids and they all feel like they're participating. But at the same time, you're honest and upfront with them. Obviously, the older the age groups get, having that many around becomes a little bit more difficult. I'd always, with my college team, for example, I mean, in a perfect scenario, if you have no guys hurt, no guys that are going to miss because of classes, 12's enough. But that's probably unrealistic. So usually we keep 14. This year I have only got 12, but, we've got somebody joining us after Christmas as well. So, but for the younger ages, I hate to discourage people, who are interested in playing and trying. You got to just kind of gauge whether having that many around is at the expense of other people, also getting, you know, repetition.
Yeah, that would be my biggest point is I've said it before on this podcast, the at that age group and younger, your number one job as a coach should be to make it fun enough that players want to come back the next year, regardless of wins and losses. They just have fun and want to come back next year. And that should be your job number one. If you have 20 kids that enjoy it and you can keep them active in practices, like you said, a taxi squad is probably the best for game situations. But if you just need to get as many people enjoying the game and coming back, and who knows, that 20th kid on your grade 7 team may be the 8th kid by grade 10 or 11. You never know. Development, kids grow, they get stronger at different times. You just never know. And it would be terrible to discourage 7 or 8 kids at grade 7 to never want to play basketball again.
I agree.
If you enjoyed what you heard, we'd appreciate if you could rate us on Apple Podcasts or tell someone about the show. It really does help others discover us. Everything we've talked about today can be found in our show notes at coachcallstimeout.com/30. Just hit the subscribe button on your Apple Podcast app or sign up for the newsletter at coachcallstimeout.com and you'll be notified when our next interview with a successful basketball coach is ready. We'll see you then.